Okay, so welcome. I am Hedy Rees, Program Director for the Center on Institutions and Governance. The title of the presentation today is, and Loïc Vacon found it, Burn Baby Burn, French Ties, Roots of the Riot in Urban France. The goal is to understand the reasons of the recent riots in France. Are they the result of failed immigration policies, or the result of social inequality and exclusion? Are they comparable to the big US riot, like, you know, in Detroit or Los Angeles? What are the prospects? So to answer those questions, we have invited two very renowned experts. First, I have Loïc Vacon. He's professor of sociology and research associate at the Earl Warren Legal Institute. And he is also a researcher at the Centre de Sociologie Européenne in Paris. He's the author of over 100 scholarly articles. And among his books, you have The Invitation to Reflexive Sociology with Pierre Bourdieu, Prisons of Poverty, Body and Soul, Ethnographic Notebooks of an Apprentice Boxer. And you have, he's working now on, on the comparative historical sociology of forms and mechanisms of racial domination over 4 centuries and 3 continents. And the title is, for the moment, Peculiar Institution. And then I have Tyler Stovall. Tyler is professor of French history at UC Berkeley since 2000. He's the author of Paris Noir, African Americans in the City of Light, The Rise of the Paris Red Belt, and his most recent book is France Since the Second World War. He's also edited a book called The Color of Liberty, History of Race in France, and he has been the director of the France Berkeley Fund with me, and we were working together, and he's the associate dean of the Social Science Division. There will be a webcasting of this event, so if you want to go back and to see it, or if you want to tell other people, just go on the website of the center. It's igov.berkeley.edu, and you will find then the link. Thank you, and now the floor is yours, Loïc.
First, I'd like to thank the Center for Institutions and Governance for organizing this event, and my colleague Tyler Stovall for agreeing to participate as a discussant, and of course for all of you for coming, including those on the web. At least, you know, I wrote my presentation from 11 p.m. last night to 5 a.m. this morning, so at least I didn't work for nothing. I've entitled my presentation "Burn Baby Burn French Style" on the roots of the riots in urban France. And then let me just make first 3 preliminary remarks. First, I'm speaking here, and I agreed to speak on short notice and to derail my normal schedule, not because I'm French, but because I'm a sociologist of urban inequality and marginality, and I have studied extensively the banlieue, the French urban periphery, that is the theater of the recent riots. I've written extensively on the comparison of the Black American ghetto with the evolution, the trajectory of the French banlieue over the last 20 years. And indeed, I conducted field work in 1989-1991 in La Courneuve, one of the banlieues of North Paris, that is one of the centers of the recent events. Second, let me stress that I'm here to provide elements to explain and to understand a salient public event, an eruption or a disruption that has shocked the national elites in France and shocked foreign observers, tarnished the image of La Belle France, and led to a great deal of vituperation and backbiting. In a sense, you know, France was giving the US a lesson on Iraq and on Katrina, that now we can get back to her and tell them, oh, what about your problems? You know, I'm not interested in this sort of, you know, game of the blame game, and I want to avoid the logic of the trial. So instead of engaging into either celebration or denigration, I want to try to help us, you know, explain and understand. Third, to do that, we must avoid 2 complementary mistakes. One is the overinterpretation of the events that leads in particular to romanticize the riots, to see them as sort of full-fledged political intervention, the expression of the resistance of the lowly, and so on. But we must also avoid the complementary mistake of underinterpretation of the events that would fail to see that even as their protest takes the form of acts of destruction and delinquency, the action of the rioters is endowed with political meaning, both subjectively as a personal response to being dissed by a Minister of the Interior, Sarkozy, who is seen as the living emblem of the excessive autonomization closing onto itself of the political field, but also that has a political meaning objectively, in particular through fighting the police as the representative of a discredited political elite, and in a sense as overdetermined by and the ability to produce effect in the political field. So now, to approach the events that bring you all, obviously a lot of people are worried about their next vacation when they go to France and they want a little advice. To approach the question, I propose to turn common sense around or upside down. And we are told about these events by the dominant representation portrayed by the media. This is a stunning, unexpected, unprecedented turn of events, comparable only to May 1968 in France or to the race riots that roiled the US in the 1960s. We are told also that it has involved uncontrolled violence, rampaging youth across the urban periphery of France, you know, with pictures, beautiful pictures entitled like Paris Burning. We are told also that these riots are crucially about ethnicity and immigration. They signal the so-called failure of the integration model of France. France, in a sense, is being punished for its unwillingness to recognize, quote, race and to fight, quote, racism, you know, two vague terms that I will use only as descriptors of the folk beliefs about the events as opposed to analytical categories that give us a purchase on it. And also we are told, relatedly, that the riots signal the emergence of full-fledged ghettos in France, thus the title that I used, ironically, Burn Baby Burn, which was the motto from the Watts riot that opened the wave of urban disorders that shook the United States in the 1960s, and that are very well chronicled in the so-called Kerner Report on Civil Disorders of 1968. And lastly, we are told that the violence has been aimless and has been deeply counterproductive. All in all, in a sense, the riots are really bad news. Well, I'm going to argue that, in some paradoxical way, the riots are rather good news on a variety of fronts. They serve, in particular, as communicative device revealing three key problems of French society. The continuing malady of the banlieue, and which has to do not with the second-generation immigrants, which, in fact, are not immigrants, but rather with the third-generation permanent unemployment and underemployment in the crumbling, decaying former Red Belt and workers' territory of the French urban periphery. The riots also reveal the growing intolerance for discrimination, particularly discrimination when it is practiced by the state, and particularly by that agency of the state known as the police. And thirdly, it is revealing of the degree of discredit of the political elite, the blindness and lameness of the state nobility that has ruled France for the last decade, and here I include the socialist government of Lionel Jospin of 1997-2002, as well as the various Chirac government that have been in place since 2002. Now, preliminary close-up observation and comparison of these riots show first that the riots are nothing new in their roots and in their form. What is novel and what is remarkable about the recent wave of riots, in a sense, is their temporal compression and their spatial diffusion and spread. And I'll return to each of these points then. Second, I'm going to argue that the violence has been neither random nor rampaging, but rather very well calibrated, made for TV, for communicating hostility to the police and rejection of the authorities. And they have been, in a sense, a way of calling on the state to live up to its pledges and to its principles. Third, they are not race riots, but rather they are at best mixed riots, like the population of the neighborhoods where they have flared up, and they are the product of the confluence of class exclusion and ethnically inflected discontent. But class, in particular unemployment and underemployment, is the primary and decisive factor, with ethnicity coming in as a secondary and accentuating factor. If you wish, in the latest blow-up, the fuse might be ethnic, but the explosive is social. And confrontation with the police as the arm of a discredited state is absolutely key to understanding what has been going on. Fourthly, I'm going to argue the French banlieues are not ghettos, but rather anti-ghettos. They are not the result of ethnic segmentation, but of class decomposition, of the breakup and the accelerating decay of the workers' territories that are so well described in Tyler Stovall's book, The Rise of the Paris Red Belt, here. And if there's somebody from University of California Press, I would urge them to put out a paperback edition, because it's really a book that you understand the making of the Red Belt, and then you say, well, what will happen when you will have its unmaking, and then you have the description of the conditions under which the riots have taken up. So the immigrant population, Mr. Chirac declared on TV last Monday that, you know, this is a problem of identity, a crisis of identity. There's no crisis of identity. The so-called immigrants are not immigrants. They are French, and they're demanding their full French rights. They have no doubt as to which community they belong to. Lastly, I'm going to argue that the violence has not been aimless and has not been counterproductive. I will argue that it's best understood as proto-political and deeply ambiguous. Ambiguous in its tenor and ambiguous in its effects. In a sense, one can argue it's been a lot more effective than the last three elections, in which the power in place took a beating in the cantonal elections of 2003, took a beating in the regional elections of 2003, then took a beating again of 2004, took a beating again in the European constitutional referendum, and yet changed absolutely nothing in its policies and even in its composition. The latest political maneuvering of Chirac, consisting, after the devastating defeat of the European Constitution, in changing a few ministers around, the same faces, you know, are still in government, and we continue with roughly the same policy. Well, at least these riots have spotlighted the growing disconnect between the political system and the lower class. They have exacerbated and demonstrated the contradictions of the policy of penalization or policierization of poverty deployed by the French government over the past decade. And it's created a breach, an opening, which can be exploited by regressive or progressive forces. And I do not agree at all with the idea that, in a sense, the big benefactor of this has been Sarkozy. This is a foregone conclusion. Le Monde today has an article showing the Sarkozy approval rating have gone up. It's a little early to say who's going to benefit from this. So let me then elaborate on each of these 5 points quickly. Here I have a quote about a diagnosis of what has been going on. I won't read the quote. You've probably read it, and I'll ask you to keep it in mind. Try to think of who could be the person who has provided this diagnosis of the events in the banlieue. Could it be a politician? If a politician, which, you know, is it Besancenot? Is it, you know, who could it be? Is it a sociologist? Is it a political scientist? You can keep that in mind. I'll return to that, and I'll reveal the author of the quote as my little treat at the end. First, the riots are nothing new in their roots and form. Low-grade rioting of this kind, characterized by running confrontation with the police, fed by mass unemployment, the casualization of labor, fostering diffuse social insecurity, relegation in declining and isolated neighborhoods where the sense of entrapment is further fed by spatial and ethnic stigmatization, these riots have been a fixture of urban France for over two decades now, starting with the wave of rioting of the late 1980s. Indeed, in 1993, I was invited to give a keynote address to the Brazilian Social Science Association, and they were mesmerized by a new phenomenon, which they wanted me to explain, the urban riots in the French banlieue. And so I gave a talk, which was published in 1994, entitled The Return of the Repressed, Urban Violence, Race and Dualization in Three Advanced Societies, in which I compare the French riots with the British riots of the 80s and with the US riots of the 60s and 80s. If you'd like to read the paper, it's available on my webpage, sociology.berkeley.edu/faculty/vacan, at the top of the page. And indeed, there are three books if you want to read more. Here is a book, Adil Jazouli, in Saison en banlieue. That was triggered by the rise of the riots in France in the 1980s. Then there was Christian Bachmann and Nicole Le Guenec, Violence Urbaine, that was triggered by a further wave of violence in the early 1990s. And then you can read the excellent book by Stéphane Beau and Michel Pialoux, Violence Urbaine, Violence Sociale, Social Urban Violence, Social Violence on the Urban Rioting of the late 1990s. So here we are, in a sense, déjà vu, all over again. But there is something new about the latest wave. What is new is the geographic scope and the temporal stretch, the simultaneity of a multiplicity of small contiguous incidents,
spread out over tens of cities across the country over 2 to 3 weeks. Indeed, the official end of the riot, in a sense, we could say, yesterday the police said, now we have returned to normal. The number of cars that are burned are back to the national average. So therefore, the events are over. So it gives us a 21-day stretch. Okay, so I'll give you some statistics and a profile of the events over these 3 week stretch. So the scale of the events, so the simultaneity and geographic scope, temporal stretch, is unique, but in reality the scale of the events, measured for instance by the number of casualties and the cost of destruction, the intensity of the riots as measured by the number of frontal confrontations with the police, are much less than prior episodes, and I'm going to provide you some evidence of that. Indeed, here is the, now if we look at the, here's a little diagram showing the sudden rise of the incidents from the day after the initial, so the initial incident was two kids from a banlieue who thought the police was about to arrest them or to check their ID cards, as they do multiple times a day in these neighborhoods. And they ran away, they went into a power station, and then there they got electrocuted and died, and the third one testified that they were trying to flee the police. This started the next day, which is the first day of the riot, a confrontation with the police, the burning of 23 cars. These are the numbers of cars, this is the index that will be used. Now, you see that first, in the initial incident, the fact that it occurred near Paris is very central. It's central because it places it close to the political power and also close access to the media. But you note, if you pay attention to the curve, you note that in the second day, this is the first day after the riot, after the initial incident, the second day there's a little tick up, the next day it starts going down, and by the fourth day, it's actually dying out. The so-called riots are over. The riots are over because it's like one of the many incidents that occur. And in a sense, it's going to be one of those riots that nobody has paid attention to, except some sociologists who have written some good books about it, but certainly that the Parisian media and the foreign media are going to be unaware of. And then what happens is the following. Sarkozy makes an inflammatory statement about youth of the banlieue, calling them scum, thugs. And then, secondarily, there's a spat between Sarkozy, a very public spat between Sarkozy, and the minister in charge of equal opportunity, the French-Moroccan sort of face of the banlieue in the current government, Azouz Begag. This, the Sarkozy remark, was public dissing of all the youth of the banlieue, who responded by immediately escalating the incident in a direct political response to, you try to deface us, we will deface you, by escalating the riots. And so what you see immediately, the next night, 68, 228, 313, and then you go all rise all the way to 1,400 cars at the peak of the right. Here, three dynamics propel this curve upward. First, a vertical contest of honor between Sarkozy and the youth, who declared that Sarkozy has to apologize or to resign, and we will continue our rioting until, in a sense, he has corrected his behavior. This was made all the more dramatic as Sarkozy has made security and the pacification of the banlieue the centerpiece of his image as an action man. You know, Sarkozy is the French equivalent of Schwarzenegger. You know, even though he didn't play into movies and he's a lifelong politician, in a sense he wants to show, I get things done, And his proving ground was going to be the banlieue, was going to be the crime in the banlieue. And so in a sense, well, you've said that you're going to do that, now you said that we are scum, now we're going to show and let's have this contest. So that's the first dynamic. Second, two horizontal races for public visibility. One race jockeying inside of the government between Villepin and Sarkozy, who are both the right-wing putative candidates of the right to the 2007 election, jockeying to position themselves as the firmer, more action-oriented leader with a view towards being the sole candidate in the 2000 presidential contest. Indeed, the initial political treatment of the riots, which helped trigger them, is really Act 1 of the presidential race of 2007. And I'm going to argue, in a sense, that's a sad comment on the state of the political system. And I'll return to that later. So that's one horizontal race. The second horizontal race is the jockeying between the different cités, the different housing projects, who then enter into a contest to make a name for themselves by getting into the news for having burned more cars than the other cité next door and for having fought the police.
And lastly, a third jockeying that is propelling this curve upward is the lack of reaction of the left and its failure to give political meaning to the initial incidents. And why? Because the Socialist Party is completely consumed in its internal battle for deciding who's going to have the upper hand inside the party and who's going to be the candidate for the 2007 elections. You know, jockeying between Hollande, Fabius, Descartes, Lang, and so on, the possible return of Jospin, who has completely consumed and blinded the socialists who failed to respond, creating this void within which the spat between Azouz Begag and Sarkozy became big news, and so was the dissing of the youth and creating this dynamic. So the riots are politically overdetermined. The stringing together of the events, the scale, the scope, the duration of the disorders is a direct byproduct of the political dynamic set off by the presidentialization of the regime that was created by the voting, the reduction of the presidential mandate from 7 to 5 years, which aligned the congressional and the presidential election, and the decision of Jospin to reverse the order of the congressional and the presidential election has created enormous pressure to presidentialize all of French politics and to make the presidential race the race that everybody expects and to turn all political activity towards that. So paradoxically, Jospin bears crucial responsibility in the setting off, indirect setting off of these riots. Second, the riots have been very spectacular, but essentially they've been made for TV and for maximum political impact. They have been neither random nor rampaging. Indeed, arguably the most distinctive feature of these riots have been how restrained they have been. They have generated few casualties and comparatively little damage. And I'm going to show you this with a brief comparison here of the Clichy-sous-Bois, which is the neighborhood, the city in which the event started, et al., you know, versus the South Central LA, 3 days of rioting with the Rodney King. And in 3 days of rioting, there was not a single death. There were 2 deaths that were announced, but actually they were deaths that occurred in the areas where there were riots, but they were not directly related. They were not caused by the riots. They were just regular neighborhood incidents. But let's count those 2 deaths. There were 126 police injured. There was no tally for civilians because there were few injured, or the few brought certainly to hospitals. There were roughly 3,000 people arrested and roughly 9,000 vehicles, cars, buses, motorcycles, and mopeds burned. Now, if you compare that to the LA Rodney King riots, 3 days instead of 21 in April of 1992, which were quelled, I remind you, by the intervention of 7,000 National Guards and 1,200 Marines, there were 45 dead, 2,400 injured, 10,000 arrested, and about $1 billion of damage. The damage for the French riots is estimated about 450 million euros, about half of the damage, or you know, 4/10 of the damage of the LA. So if you do a comparison, and you actually compute a rate of damage of casualty per day of rioting, you observe that overall the LA Rodney King riots in a single city generated 158 times more deaths per day than the French riots, that the Rodney King riots were 133 times more injuries, were 24 times more arrests per day of rioting, and created 18 times more damage in monetary term per day of rioting. So really, very small impact in terms of the actual damage, no comparison. Indeed, if you compare also with previous riots occurring in France, for instance, the Vaux-en-Velin riot of October 1990, which I studied in my 1993 paper, you see that in 3 days of clashes between the local youth and the police, there were 200 cars burned, 70 injured, and damage estimated $120 million at the time. In 2 days, dollar value rate, basically that single Vaux-en-Velin riot of 1990 created half the damage of 21 days of rioting throughout France created. So clearly, another way to assess the riot is to say, okay, 9,000 cars were burned, but that needs to be compared to the 28,000 cars that were burned in France during the first 10 months of the year without any outrage or riots going on, in a sense, the normal rate of car burning. If you wish, if you compute a rate, you could say that the riots of the last 3 weeks have done about 3 months of rioting in 3 weeks. You know, 3 months of car burning in about 3 weeks. So an acceleration of by a rate of 4 of the normal low-grade silent riots that are going on as the media doesn't pay attention. The total damage was estimated to be about 450 million. 200 million of this is public damage to schools, social centers, buses that have been burned, destroyed. €200 million is private damage of about 10% for the burned cars. In fact, the burned cars, which cost on average €3,500, is such that the insurance companies have announced that they will pay all of the cars, even the people who are not insured, and that this will not affect the cost of car insurance because this is minor. This is 250 million out of 14 billion of car damages paid yearly by the insurance industry. So a drop in the bucket. Now, then it means, well, a drop in the bucket, but still there's all this, this is pretty spectacular. So we must then pay attention to the ritualized quality and, in a sense, the meaning of the burning of cars, the burning of garbage cans, cars, schools, gymnasia, which are primarily a means of drawing the police in so that when you have them in, then you can engage in a confrontation with them, you can storm them, you can shout at them, you can throw things, and you can fight with them or with the firefighters, who are seen as a representative of a discredited state. So now, there has been wide incomprehension that the rioters would burn cars, store schools. After all, they're burning the things, you know, their own cars, they're burning the schools that they need, and so on and so forth. But these cars, stores, and schools are the very symbols and instruments of access to the sort of stable life that these youth are being denied. Buses and cars are means and symbols of physical mobility, symbols of socioeconomic stability. It takes a stable job to buy a car in installment, the kind of job that you don't have. Schools are institutions that either exclude them outright or include them, but even when they have gotten a degree, fail to deliver on the promise of occupational success and cultural acceptance. They are not the so-called social elevators that the politicians talk about, but rather traps that consign lower-class youth of immigrant and French origins alike to a life of marginality, even as they claim to offer a way out, thus the anger against the school. The police are the frowning face of the state that does not deliver on its promise of liberty, equality, and fraternity, to which I'll return later. I'll return to the question of the police. Basically, the police are representatives of the discredited power that abuse their authority and reinforce the feeling of indignity and of being second-class citizen. So there's clearly a practical proto-political rationality to these events. It's destroy to express anger, rage, outrage, discredit, the discredit of the state, but do not create so much damage as to elicit castigation or real damage to persons in particular. It's particularly remarkable that in the setting buildings on fire, for instance, schools and social centers, this is always done at night so that you ensure that there's no one in there and that you will have no human casualties. It's also very remarkable that all the so-called, you know, shooting at the police, that when the police enter these neighborhoods, some of which look like, you know, they're very, very large public housing concentrations, with buildings sometimes that run for, you know, 100 or 200 yards of, you know, 15 stories with, you know, potentially maybe 1,000 windows looking at you, that they are shooting at the police with live ammunition, with guns and rifles, and yet they haven't managed to kill or injure seriously a single police. Clearly, you know, either you're a very bad shooter or you're not aiming at the police, or certainly you're not aiming to kill. So always firing at the police, but always missing them, bizarrely. So, third element. The dominant frame of the interpretation of the events has been quickly established. These are race riots. They are instigated by immigrants who have, quote, failed to integrate. France has, quote, a race problem. France was in denial, and the reality has come back to hound it and to punish it or her. Its insistence to not officially recognize ethnic groups, to refuse to count by race, is putting it into an impasse. Now the problem, you know, the snake has come back to bite it. Where does this interpretation come from? It comes largely from the skin color of the perpetrators of the riots. As you see pictures from TV, you see a lot of colored faces. And so therefore the immediate interpretation, well, this must be motivated by racial considerations. Well, think of the analogy. The French soccer national team has a lot of black faces on it. In fact, sometimes it's all black faces on the football field. Yet when you look at the French team, I don't think many people would say that race is what determines them to be on the team. Yet when you see a team of rioter, it seems, you know, sort of commonsensical to say, oh, but what determined them to be on the team of rioter was their race. Well, think of how the analogy works or doesn't work. Now, the frame, it comes from the framing by the media, by politicians, and by experts. Why? Because race or ethnicity or the whole question of discrimination has become a screen to avoid having to look at a much deeper problem. In a sense, in the 1980s, as the Red Belt banlieue the traditional workers' territories, which are a very peculiar urban configuration, as Tyler shows very well in his book, made up of the integration of factory work as the dominant economic underpinning, but also a very dense network of association and organization that tie the world of work to the municipal political authority, to the world of unions, to the world of associations, and create a working class centered universe in which there's a tight integration of space, of residence, of community, of organization, and of politics in one, in a sense, hanging together. And this has been, you know, unhinged, and this has been decomposing. Now, this decomposition was masked in the 1980s. The left politicians couldn't say we are leading a political, an economic policy that is destroying the working class that is supposed to be our electoral basis. So they said instead that what we have now is a problem of territory, the problem of the banlieue, a problem of neighborhood. And so the territory, the territorialization of social problems was a way of avoiding facing the new social question of the unmaking of the urban proletariat, and in a sense the remaking of a new dispersed and incoherent new urban proletariat and subproletariat. Then in the 1990s, another screen was advanced to look at this. It was a screen of ethnicity and culture, and there was a whole discussion about, you know, ethnicity and multiculturalism and so on. And then by the late 1990s and the early current decade, a third screen was advanced, the screen of insecurity and crime and criminality. And in a sense, today we're seeing a combination of these two. This is a question of crime, but there's also a question of identity and ethnicity and discrimination and recognition. You know, and the government will set up programs to recognize, to lessen, you know, discrimination. As we say in French, to have a program to lessen discrimination, ça ne mange pas de pain. You know, it says, you know, it doesn't eat bread. It doesn't cost you anything. You're saying, oh, look, there are some bad employers, and there are some bad landlords who don't want to rent or don't want to hire foreigners or people who look like foreigners. We're going to say, oh, they're bad boys. You know, and we're going to set up programs where people can, you know, can protest. Or we're going to enlarge the legal means of obtaining redress. But meanwhile, you're not saying, well, you know, we need to create an employment program. We need to create, you know, 2 million jobs in these urban peripheries. And this is going to cost, you know, about 20 to 30 billion euros, which we don't have because we're trying to vote a tax reduction for the upper middle class and upper class. So this is the reason why the framing by the media and the politicians, paradoxically the politicians of the left, have an even greater incentive to trot out the question of the territory and ethnicity and criminality than the politicians of the right, because for them the deficit of legitimacy of having to recognize that their policies is destroying their traditional electorate is much greater than the politicians of the right. There's also been, parallel to this, the resurgence of the colonial question. And the research and then the rediscovery by France, the belated discovery of its colonial past, and, you know, distant and not so distant. Okay, and I think that's an independent, you know, movement, that's an independent dynamic, but that has come in a sense, and that is interfered with arriving at a proper diagnosis of this question of the riots. And lastly, there's been the reading by the foreign media, particularly by the US media, that bring in a sense racialized lenses to the situation, and of course has all the reasons in the world to want to read its own domestic problems into the problems of others, so that it universalizes its own racial question by saying that it's happening everywhere else. So this is a very good illustration of the tendency in public discourse, as well as in social science, to take ethnicity and race for granted, to see it everywhere, to over-ethnicize conflict. As soon as there are some ethnically inflected population involved, there's an excellent article on the topic by Rogers Brubaker and David Layton in a recent issue of Annual Review of Sociology on Ethnic Violence. I urge you to read that excellent essay. But these are, at best, mixed riots, mixed like the neighborhoods in which they have erupted. They are the product of the confluence of class exclusion and ethnically inflected discontents, particularly treatment by the police. But class, unemployment and underemployment, breeding long-term marginality, is the decisive factor, with ethnicity coming in as a secondary, an aggravating factor. In a sense, the presence of the so-called immigrant youth, who are not immigrants, you know, are, you know, they are very visible, and they are, in a sense, at the forefront of the riots, because they are, you know, much deeply hurt by the deproletarianization, by the casualization of labor, by the normalization of desocialized, insecure labor as the normal horizon for the unskilled working class, for the generations to come. Recently, the head of the MEDEF, the so-called Mouvement des Entreprises de France, the business round, the French equivalent of the business round table, announced, Madame Parizeau, she announced that precariousness. People are protesting precarious jobs, but precariousness is like a law of nature. Precariousness, you have precariousness in love relationships, you have precariousness in the weather, you have precariousness in jobs is, you know, it's just, you know, people just have to face up to the reality that, you know, it was abnormal that we were providing all these, you know, guarantees for employment. Now we just have to go back to the law of nature. Now here, I don't have the time to go into a deep analysis, but I'll send you to my 1993 paper that's on my webpage. The structural causes in 2005 are the same as they were in 1993. Mass and persistent and chronic unemployment amounting for entire segments of the working class to outright deproletarianization, bringing in its wake pervasive material deprivation. Secondly, relegation into decaying neighborhoods in which public and private resources diminish just as competition for them increases, particularly by the entry into immigrants in those neighborhoods from which they were historically excluded. And it's not that the neighbors are becoming more segregated, the neighbors are becoming less segregated. The foreigners and the immigrants used to be much more segregated, much more kept apart and not allowed, in a sense, to compete and to access the public institutions. And today they are accessing the public institution. Thirdly, the heightened stigmatization in daily life and in public discourse of these neighborhoods, all of which are more deadly for occurring against the backdrop of a general upswing in inequality. Now, since 1993, now if I had to rewrite that paper, I would add three factors. First, further deproletarization and casualization of labor that has increased the increased incident and intensity of social insecurity. And here, let's just a little sneak off. And here, so on the interpretation of the, you know, the dominant interpretation of the, this is Libération, mot de ghetto. This is, you know, this is a map that Le Monde published of the proliferation of ghetto neighborhoods in France. By which they mean, if you look in detail, what do they mean by ghetto neighborhood? The so-called 752 zone urbaine sensible, which are the neighborhoods targeted by a special urban policy, urban renewal plan, which are neighborhoods that are, you are put into this list by virtue of high unemployment, low school achievement, low income, high rates of a variety of social problems. Well, then no wonder that afterwards you say, and then as you lower, and you can decide, you can put 350 of them or you can put 750 of them. So the French government started its urban policy by having 90 of them in 1989. Then in the 1990s, it decided the policy is not working, let's have 200 neighborhoods. When the policy didn't work, they say, well, let's have 400 neighborhoods. And in the latest wave in 1996, there were 750 neighborhoods. But it's a purely administrative decision. So the so-called proliferation of ghetto neighborhood, in fact, entails neighborhoods, as you can see here, that have a high proportion of people under 20 years of age, that have a high proportion of people without high school or university degrees, that have an unemployment rate above the average, and that have a low proportion of homeowners. And you're like, well, and these are the neighborhoods. Yes, and you know what? Well, these are the criteria by which the neighborhoods are selected. So how surprising is it that, you know, that the neighborhoods in this category would have these properties? This is the official administrative designation. Now, here is the story that this is hiding. The spread of social insecurity among the youth in the so-called zone urbaine sensible, sensitive urban zones. If you pay attention to this table that I dug up from data from the INSEE from a 2001 study, which revealed that sensitive urban areas, it's an article called Sensitive Urban Areas, the rapid increase in unemployment between 1990 and 1999. And it revealed that job precariousness and social insecurity have become generalized and concentrated during that decade. Now remember that decade, particularly the period 97-2000, is a decade of prosperity. So prosperity has brought what into these neighborhoods? More unemployment and more casual employment. Indeed, the number of precarious workers nationwide, now precarious workers are those on short-term contracts, temporary staff, subsidized jobs, has gone up from 2 million to basically 3.5 million now. Nationally, this goes from 1 in 11 workers to 1 in 7 workers. In the ZUS, 1 in 5 workers is... Now, that's not counting the unemployed. Now, if you look in these neighborhoods, you see what's the percentage unemployed. The percentage unemployed went from one-fifth to one-fourth during the past decade. The percentage overall, nationally, in the ZUS, it went from 28 to 40%. While, you know, France was experiencing prosperity and growth. If you add those who are, in a sense, in precarious job positions, you add another 20%, which means that, as of today, about two of every three youths 18 to 30, is either unemployed or employed in a precarious position. So we can see why, of course, Jospin lost big in the lower class neighborhoods, where people either didn't go vote or voted for extreme right or extreme left. We can also see how, after three successive crushing defeats at the polls, Chirac continues to implement a policy that further deregulates the labor market, and the latest announcement of Villepin of the new deregulation, the creation of the new labor employment contract that will allow firms to hire and fire you at will for 2 years, is basically saying to the youth of these neighborhoods, you know what, you've had some of this medicine of, you know, insecure employment, and we're going to extend and generalize that. Second element that is different from 1993 is the shift to the penalization of poverty. And here I'll direct you to my books, Prisons of Poverty and Punishing the Poor, in which there's been a rolling out of aggressive policing as a means of containing the social disorders accumulating in this declining urban periphery. This was started in 1997 under the Jospin government, and this was accelerated by Raffarin Sarkozy after the 2002 presidential election that crowned insecurity as the winning theme of the election. Now, in 1993, I wrote in my, and you'll excuse me for citing myself, for the disaffected youth of declining urban enclaves, then the police are the last buffer between them and society, and they represent the enemy. Trespassers in a territory where their rule is often openly contested and in which they incite defiance and hostility, if not aggression. And indeed, you know, this is pretty much what we have witnessed. Now, so since Chirac came back to power in 2002, there's been an acceleration of the policy of, in a sense, police management of social disorders in the urban periphery. And there's been a shift in the policing tactic away from so-called community policing and problem-resolving police, where the police were supposed to get to know their neighborhood youth and sort of be an ongoing presence, towards very harsh frisk and arrest policies, stop and frisk policies, campaigns, sweep, intensive surveillance. So more belligerent policing at ground level, which has been more disruptive, made more disruptive by the built-in impunity of the police, which for a variety of historical and political reasons in France operates in complete, you know, with basically very few means of controlling their behavior and redressing, you know, police brutality and abuse. I'll give you just one example that gives you an idea of the degree of impunity that the police enjoys in France. You have probably seen, all of you, the New Orleans incident of Mr. Robert Davis being beat up by the New Orleans police in the French Quarter in early October. It was shown ad nauseam on every cable TV, every channel. If you haven't seen it 100 times, it's because your TV was shut down. But there was an exactly similar incident last week of a police beating of a youth from the banlieue around a riot by 6 French policemen. He was shot by Antenne 2. He was shown on national TV on the 8 o'clock news. Immediately, Sarkozy, it was so obvious, here he is on the ground with police beating him. Sarkozy immediately called for the police to be, you know, apprehended, for one of them to be jailed, which is extremely rare. The next day, Antenne 2 had taken the video off of its webpage. If you go to the archives of the news of Antenne 2, which owns the tape, you will find that the only day missing of the news that you can't watch is the day when this video was shown. The video is unfindable. Why? Because you can't infringe on the dignity of the French police. To have this video is inflammatory. It's an affront to the dignity of the police. So there was enormous political pressure put on the media, and a leading, you know, media outlet agreed to withdraw this video from circulation. And it has it's been seen only once on the 8 o'clock news, and that was it. That gives you just, you know, a little idea of the degree of impunity that the police enjoys. So, on the one side, the Sarkozy strategy of increasing aggressive policing in this neighborhood has, in a sense, created a more grating and explosive situation. And on the other side, the Raffarin government have cut a number of social and educational programs in those same neighborhoods. And so the combination of the increase in police presence and intervention and the cuts in social and educational programs have created, in a sense, a situation ripe for an incident to occur and for the incidents to spread from there. Last argument about the so-called ghettoization. Put this as an illustration. Mode ghetto. These riots are occurring in the French banlieue, and the French banlieue are said to be ghettos. Well, I've spent a fair amount of time studying the question, and the ghetto, the banlieue are really not ghettos, rather they are anti-ghettos. They have, in a sense, the obverse properties of ghettos. And the riots are not the result of ethnic segmentation, but of class decomposition, the breakup, accelerating decay of the work class territories. First, these banlieues are not majority immigrants, but majority French, even French of white skin and French European descent, with large and variable presence of immigrants. They contain a typically immigrant presence of 15 to 30 nationalities, so very, very spread out, with no cultural unity, no common language, no overarching identity. Now, if there's one thing that characterizes ghettos historically, whether it's the Jewish ghetto in Renaissance Europe or the Black American ghetto during the 20th century, is on the contrary, ethnic homogeneity and a common language and a shared culture and a clear identity, a clear territory that belongs to one group. Well, the characteristic of these territories, it doesn't belong to one group. Second, also, is typically the ghetto contained the totality of the group that is ghettoized. That is, Jews in Renaissance Europe, it's not like there's 10% of the Jews in the ghetto and 90% outside. And African Americans, when the ghetto of Chicago arises in the interwar years, it's not like there's 90% of blacks outside the black belt and then 10% inside. Well, here, this is exactly the situation that we have, is that about 10% of the immigrants, or immigrant-descended populations, are in these neighborhoods. And most of them do not live in these neighborhoods. Basically, I mean, calling these neighborhoods ghettos is a fundamental misunderstanding of what a ghetto is. It is confusing a ghetto with a segregated territory, with a territory of poverty, with a territory of dereliction, with a territory of destitution. But really, a ghetto is not that. A ghetto is a very peculiar sort of urban animal that combines several different elements. A ghetto is an urban container of a stigmatized population that is constrained to reside in a particular area, where it will have its own territory, and within this territory develop its own parallel social institutions that will contain the life of the group. So a ghetto historically is comprised of four elements: stigma, constraint, spatial confinement, and institutional encasement and parallelism. That's in a sense a constructed definition of the ghetto that fits the Black American experience in the United States, the Jewish experience in Europe, or the Burakumin in Japan. Now, does it fit? It doesn't fit at all, for instance, the experience of European migrants in the American city during the 20th century, which were ethnic clusters and not ghettos, nor does it fit the experience of streams of migrants into Western Europe, which are, in a sense, ethnic clusters and neighborhoods that, as opposed to ghettos. There is no institutional parallel structure that replaces the institution of the broader society and contains the residents of the neighborhood within these banlieues. Precisely, the complaint of the residents is the institutional vacuum that they face, is the lack of organizations and institutions. The failure of the state to deliver the normal goods that are to be expected of every French citizen. Their failure to, and their demands is not to develop their own homegrown group-specific institutions, but on the contrary, that the state provide them with the normal public services to which every French citizen is entitled. So if you look, in a sense, in terms of the function of the ghetto historically is to dissimulate a group, is to keep it separated. It's not to assimilate and to allow it to enter into the broader society. That's not the function of this banlieue. A ghetto historically is ethnically homogeneous. That's exactly the opposite of what we're seeing. And a ghetto historically is organizationally strong and has its own parallel institutions. And this is exactly the opposite of what we're seeing. And so in many ways, the French banlieue, like the British inner city, like the German immigrant clusters, and so on and so forth, are not ghettos, but anti-ghettos. Related to that is the question of the so-called failure of the integration model, and I can't go in depth into that, but one of the explanations, one of the tropes that strutted out to explain the latest riots is to say, well, France had this model of integration, which used to work, which was that you integrated by entering into, by participating into the school, the church, and military service, and you learn the great ideals of La Belle France, and you become French. Well, you know, the failure of the integration model is not a failure today, it's a failure from the very beginning, because integration has never occurred in this fashion. The incorporation of immigrants into French population, and their, in a sense, their transmutation from foreigners into French people, was never operated according to the school, the military service, and to the church. It was operated by incorporation into the working class. And the instruments of integration have always been the factory, the work organizations, and the neighborhood-based organization of the traditional worker territory that are attached on the one side to the world of work, and on the other side to the political associations of the left, and particularly the Communist Party. This is the integration. This has been the integration machine of France from the 1880s to basically the 1980s, for a century of integration, has never occurred according to the so-called Republican model. It's occurred through class integration. And the breakdown of the model of integration in France has nothing to do with the Republican ideal. It has to do with the breakdown and the decomposition of the working class. Is that, in a sense, the bridge from foreign to national used to be the passage through working class organization. Well, as the working class decomposes, that bridge is no longer there. So where is the bridge? Well, now the bridge is the neighborhood, the school, access to public services, access to public institutions. And so paradoxically, and what is happening? In fact, what is happening is that immigrants are being integrated. They are being integrated in a conflictual manner. And it's precisely because so-called integration, or at least incorporation of immigrants, is functioning that it is creating problems. If the immigration were not being incorporated, if they were, in a sense, remain segregated as they were in the 50s and 60s and early 70s, if they remain in their separate sonacotra cité, in which they were absolutely no French people, it was all foreigners by definition, if they had their parallel institutions, of which they did have in the slums that ringed Paris in the 1950s and 60s, as described, for instance, in that Abdelmalek Sayad's beautiful book on Un Enterre Algérien, then, in a sense, it wouldn't be a problem. But the problem is that precisely that they have entered into public housing, they have entered and accessed, in a sense, the public institutions, and in a sense, France is finally, at long last, living up to its Republican ideal, is that immigrant incorporation is operating through the model of the school and access to public institutions, and it is creating this problem. Now, I have a whole battery of indicators where I could show you this. If you look at the demography of immigrant population, you can show that the family structure, the fertility, the mortality, morbidity patterns are becoming very rapidly like the native French population. If you look at access to school, at school success, at access at the occupational structure, and at occupational mobility, controlling for class. And that's the critical variable. Because the immigrants, particularly North African immigrants, Algerians and Moroccans, preeminently Algerians, are overwhelmingly working class and overwhelmingly from the lower sectors of the working class, they have very high rates of unemployment, very low rates of school success, but when you actually control and you compare French working class, French homegrown working class family and Algerian working class family, you observe that actually the Algerian sons and daughters of the French sons and daughters of these Algerian families have actually a higher rate of school success, a higher occupational structure, and now what they don't, and the higher rate of unemployment. And that's where we ought to return to the specificity of discrimination on the labor market, discrimination in relation to the police, discrimination on the housing market, but discrimination that occurs within the context of the overall integration of the immigrant population. And indeed, it is the incorporation that is creating opportunities for discrimination, because if they were keeping separate, there would be no opportunity to discriminate against them. Now, what has increased now, you know, we can maybe address that in the discussion, but, you know, has there been, is the increase in discrimination one of the roots in the rise? No, I think, in fact, the indicators, you know, it's hard to tell discrimination from disparity, and it's hard to ferret out and so on, but all of the indicators that we have suggest that probably there's a decrease in discrimination, but in an increase in the intolerance for discrimination that continues to exist. And so the increased intolerance makes any incident of discrimination, you know, very much more salient. Now last, and I'll close with that, we are told the violence is aimless and has been unproductive. I've argued, on the contrary, that it's been proto-political violence, deeply ambivalent and ambiguous in its meaning and effects. If you compare it to the effect of defeating the sitting government three times in a row with humiliating defeats, which has changed absolutely nothing in their policies, but certainly the rights have been more effective, because they've already forced the government to immediately refund the social and the educational programs that they had cut, resulting in the infusion of an immediate 100 million euros into the poorest neighborhoods of the country. They have immediately put the question of discrimination on the political map. They have forced the government to restore 5,000 pedagogical assistants to schools for the 1,200 most underprivileged high schools in the ZUS. They have led to the announcement of the creation of 100,000 fellowships for deserving students from these areas. 20,000 publicly subsidized jobs will be targeted to these neighborhoods. Recipients of social minima will get a bonus of 1,000 euros if they find a job. If they find a job, they will keep 1,000 euros as a bonus for finding a job, and they will get to keep 150 euros of their daily social assistance stipend, even as they work. There will be a doubling of the number of adult supervisors that provide a link between families and public institutions. And there's now a discussion of returning to a less harsh style of policing. Well, if you say it's been a lot more successful than voting against this government. I mean, it's sad to say. And this takes us to the last point, which is, in a sense, the sad news that this brings about the state of the political system. And so I'll close with that, is say that the riots have demonstrated very visibly the inability and the built-in contradictions of the policy of penalization of poverty. Is that you want to control these neighborhoods by force? You don't have enough police. You can't do it. You want to process people through the criminal justice system? The judges, the right-wing union of judges, immediately protested the measure that said we will process people quickly because there's not enough judges. The criminal justice system is crumbling. You cannot manage your poor population with your criminal justice apparatus, except if you're the United States, which has 2.1 million people behind bars and is spending the money for it. So it has demonstrated the untenability of the penalization of poverty. The police is not numerous enough, can't control things everywhere, the courts are overwhelmed. And then the spiral of penalization is endless. As you treat social ills in lower class neighborhoods with your police, you only create more instability and more disorders, and you aggravate the very ills that you're supposed to treat. And so you periodically create erupting incidents that force you to divert more and more resources to lose the social control of the neighborhoods, depletes your social and economic resources to really attack the roots, and creating an ongoing festering situation. So the riots, paradoxically, to conclude, I think bear good news about French society at one level. First, the refusal of marginalization by lower class youth in these neighborhoods. In a sense, you could say if they weren't rioting, it would mean that they are accepting their fate. They're accepting the treatment of, insecure wage jobs, lousy jobs for the rest of your life, and, brutal, abrasive police as your daily fare. And you can read the latest riot as sort of an urban Jacquerie. Jacquerie is an expression that describes the traditional peasant revolts of the feudal era. That comes from a 1358 episode in the Beauvaisis, where the peasants revolted against the lord and the king out of the confluence of three elements. Poverty, because there was the 100-year war, and the lords were levying a tax to pay for the freeing of the king who had been captured by the British, and so on. So a decline, a drop in the standard of living. Clearly, things are not going to get better. A discrediting of the political elite, of the lords of the time, were embroiled in this war and who are not providing protection, who are not providing what they're supposed to provide, exactly as the French state is not providing what it's supposed to provide. And thirdly, the political authority are not controlling the police of the day. Now, the police of the day was the so-called, in 1358, was the so-called écorcheurs. They were the mercenaries that were hired by the lords and by the king to fight their war. And as the war kept going on, the écorcheurs turned against the peasant population and was abusing and abusing the peasant population. And the Jacquerie was a revolt against these three conditions. And in a sense, what we are seeing is an urban Jacquerie against the state, for allowing, in a sense, poverty and insecurity to fester, to continue, and promising more of the same, allowing its police to be brutal and abrasive, and being thoroughly discredited. Now, so the good news is about the capacity of the lower class to refuse this long-term marginalization, this silencing, the normalization of parallel lives, lifelong social insecurity and invisibility, which the U.S. subproletariat has been forced to accept by a combination of radical individualism, workfare, and hyper-incarceration. But it brings bad news about the politicians and about the state of the political system. In a sense, the traditional complaint of the French about the American political system is that it has lost all autonomy, it's dominated by the powers of money. Well, the complaint that one can launch to the French political system is that it's become overly autonomous. It's become totally unresponsive to the social demands which it is supposed to translate into public policies. It has become completely closed onto itself, responding only to its own internecine fights. And now we return to the site that I gave you, and this will give you an idea of the degree of discredit of the French political elite. Because have you guessed who this great analyst of urban riots is?
We can't read it back here.
Oh. This is Jacques Chirac. This is candidate Jacques Chirac in the 1995 presidential election campaign, saying, I will treat the social fracture, the break that is separating the lower class from the rest of society, the accumulation of employment, of despair. You know, we need an about turn in our economic and social policies. The same Jacques Chirac who in 2002 will then run on a campaign, we ought to fight insecurity and crime. The same Jacques Chirac who came on TV last Monday, the same Jacques Chirac who is known in this banlieue as super voleur, super thief. You know, who during the 2002 presidential campaign, when he ventured rarely in these neighborhoods, was showered with eggs, you know, and you know, all kinds of debris, and insulted on French TV as super voleur, super thief, for all of the, you know, illegal shenanigans that he played, for all the graft and the diversion of public money when he was mayor of the city of Paris. Jacques Chirac, who would be in prison had he not been re-elected in 2002, who is telling the lower class population, we cannot admit crime, we cannot admit disorder, this republic is about respect for the law. Here I am telling you, here I am, you know, here I am running in 2002 on a campaign of impunity for crime, when I'm the, you know, the biggest criminal of them all, sitting in the Élysée Palace. So the discredit of the politicians is just, I mean, has reached a level that is to sort of become, you know, truly surreal. And the self-closure, the excessive autonomization of the political system unto itself is really what these riots reveal. And ultimately this shows that really the neoliberal state, which the state nobility of France is now building, is really a schizophrenic state. It is, you know, liberal at the top, non-interventionist, we have to pull out, we can no longer provide you with jobs, we can no longer provide you with social assistance, we are going to have a small state on the economic and social front. But it is intrusive, growing, and paternalist at the bottom when it comes to handling the social consequences of these policies of economic deregulation and social welfare retrenchment. It is, in a sense, a paternalist state head mounted on a liberal body. This is why I call this regime liberal paternalism. It gives all freedoms to firms, to the upper class, to the market, but it reduces the freedom of the lower class by putting them under close police supervision and curtailing their freedom. It tends to criminalize and even, as we see, militarize the consequences of urban marginality and subjects problem populations and territories to intrusive penal control. But the penalization of poverty only creates more instability and insecurity and will create periodic riots of the kind that we have seen. I predict here that we will see more of these riots, and I think that we will see more of these riots before the French presidential campaign goes into full swing. This is one of a number of riots that will occur. And it remains to be seen if these contradictions that the riots have revealed, the good news about the capacity of the lower class to still resist and try to express itself in a proto-political fashion, but the extreme degree of lameness and blindness of the state nobility and the closing onto itself of the political system, whether the opening that was created and whether the contradictions that were spotlighted will be resolved during the presidential campaign. In a sense, you know, whether the outcome of this opening will be regressive or progressive, depending on the political interpretation and the political work that is done now. So there is much political work to be done. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Louis, for that very stimulating talk. And what I'm going to do is just offer a few remarks, basically off the cuff.
Oh. Can you hear me? Okay. What I'm going to do is simply offer a few remarks off the cuff, both reactions to Louis' talk and to the situation we've seen developing. I've found that following the news from France has become sort of a day job. The latest thing I've seen, for example, in reports from various newspapers is that one of the accusations is that the riots are due to Islamic polygamy practiced in the suburbs, right? And that is the entire cause of the situation.
Africa's villages being reconstituted right. in the banlieue.
That's right, that's right. Let me make a couple points about that. First of all, one thing that we did not talk about so much is the issue of religion, and which has become a major issue. Let me cite, just for example, the latest issue of a major news source, U.S. News and World Report, which has a cover article, series of cover articles, Europe's New Agony, Why Muslims are so angry, Is It Religion or Culture? And What's Next? And they talk about heavily populated Muslim suburbs in France, which, to my knowledge, do not really exist. Everybody is labeled a Muslim, even people that don't look anything like the traditional French Muslim. And it is all a matter of Muslim anger against the West. So, a couple things about that. First of all, France does have a large Muslim population. As many historians and scholars have pointed out, they are by no means uniform, they are by no means even practicing. And even though there is certainly a Muslim fundamentalist presence in France, it's by no means representative of the majority of the population. So much so that as various surveys have shown, even when the issue of the veil has come up, the issue of the right of Islamic schoolgirls to wear the chador, the veil, in public school, many Muslims in France have been opposed to this and have seen it as an importation of Islamic fundamentalism, especially those who have come from Algeria and see this as an importation of an Algerian issue into French politics. So this is by no means a homogeneous community politically or religiously. And yet, especially in the United States, it seems, religion has become the key marker as a way of labeling these people. So the issue of religion, I think, is something that has to be dealt with. And I think a general reaction I would have to Loïc's talk is to say that I think he's absolutely right in emphasizing the role of class. At the same time, we have to look at why other people, why both people in France and people outside of France are not talking about it in terms of class or talking about it in terms of race and religion. Let me make a couple of other points, and I really don't want to give a whole speech here because I want to allow plenty of time for discussion. Loïc alluded to the whole issue of the colonial past. And the issue of France's colonial past, which has been brought up by lots of foreign commentators, especially Americans who want to say, nya, 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 we don't have a colonial past, but you do, is very varied. First of all, many of these people in the banlieue are of colonial origin. In one way or another. It's certainly true of North Africans. It is certainly true of many of the people from Black Africa. By the way, one group that has I have yet to see mentioned, at least in any of the American reporting and hardly any of the French reporting, is people from the French Caribbean, who are normally lumped in with the so-called immigrants, even though it is very hard to be an immigrant when you're coming from a territory that has been French ever since the early 17th century, longer than certain parts of metropolitan France. And yet they're all lumped together as sort of gens de couleur immigrés. And the other thing I wanted to point out is that, very much to my dismay, there's a particular French phrase which has unfortunately jumped the Atlantic and adopted uncritically by the American press, and that is the phrase second-generation immigrant. Now, if you think about that term, it is a complete absurdity. There is no such thing as a second-generation immigrant. Either you were born in a country where you live or you are not. What that has traditionally meant is the idea that, well, you may be born in France, but because you do not fit what a French person is supposed to be, therefore you're still an immigrant. The other thing about this term, by the way, is interesting, is that demographically it doesn't really work anymore, because this is something that's really inherited from the 1980s and early 1990s. It would perhaps be more accurate now to talk about a third generation. There's a wonderful book, by the way, if you're interested in reading more about this, by a man named Paul Silverstein, an anthropologist, called Algeria and France, which talks about the rise of the third generation, the so-called, not the Beur, which is the second generation, but the so-called Rabeus, which is the inversion of Beur, just as Beur was the inversion of Arab. And these people have a very different view of France and of their place in France, as do the Beur generation. The other thing about, well, a couple of other things about France's colonial past. There has been a lot of attention recently to an incident in France's colonial slash post-colonial history, because it's not really certain which one it was, and that was the demonstration that took place at the end of October in October 1961 at the end of the Algerian War in Paris, a demonstration mounted by the French the National Liberation Front of Algeria, which was heavily suppressed by the police. And which resulted in the death of some 200 Algerians in the center of Paris in one night, October 17, 1961. This is interesting for a number of reasons. First of all, that the news of the riot was very much suppressed and has only really come to light in the last 10 years. Secondly, it is also true that the French the police organizations to this day refuse to admit any wrongdoing, or refuse to, when there was a proposal for creating a statue honoring the dead of October 17, 1961 in Paris, they fought against it, saying that you also have to take into context the fact that the FLN was assassinating French policemen, so on and so forth. And third is another issue, which is that the demonstration that took place, in effect, was the demonstration of Algerians that lived in the banlieue coming into the center of the city on the night of October 17, 1961. It constituted a kind of invasion of the center city by the suburban population. And I highlight that because last weekend there was all this news about the French police were suspected there was going to be a similar kind of invasion of the center city. There were sort of police units were thrown up around all the major monuments in central Paris, and there was this fear that there was going to be this kind of invasion. If you look at many different novels, films, so on and so forth that chronicle the experience of French suburbs, especially those of Paris, you will often find this kind of invasion motif. If you look at, for example, Mathieu Kassovitz's La Haine, there's a scene where the youth of the banlieue go into the center city and are seen as very, very different, and also seen as a kind of invader. This is the historical role of the suburbs in France, the place where civilization ends, the place where the people beyond the pale, excuse the phrase, are kept. And there's a way in which these kinds of suburban areas replicate the same kind of division between metropole and colony that existed during France's colonial empire, that in effect they are a kind of internal colony, not just because of the characteristics of their population, but also because of the role they play in French life. One of the things I really, I don't want to say enjoyed about this last few weeks, but have really appreciated is the fact that finally people know there are kinds of things like suburbs, that Paris does stop at the Arc de Triomphe and the Tour Eiffel and stuff like that. In fact, if you look at Paris, for example, 9 million people live in Greater Paris. Only 2 million people live in the city of Paris itself. Now, this is a very varied area. Sarkozy is himself a mayor of a Paris suburb, Neuilly. But when people talk about Neuilly, Neuilly is not La Banlieue. La Banlieue is the 93, the 93 area northeast of Paris. And it represents not just a geographical space, but a social space, and an idea of exclusion from the French mainstream. Now, a couple of other points. There's also been a lot of comparisons with the contemporary situation to May of 1968, which is very interesting, because there are certain parallels. For one thing, the level of violence, to burning cars, for example. And I think Loic's analysis of the whole issue of the burning car is really interesting. One of my favorite books, by the way, is a book by the literary scholar Kristen Ross, Fast Cars, Clean Bodies, which is about France during the 1950s and 1960s. She makes the argument that one of the major sort of tropes of post-war France is the car crash. And she talks about all the people like Albert Camus and others that died in car crashes. Well, if the trope of the 1950s is the car crash, maybe that of the end of the 20th century, early 21st century, is the burning car. And I think Loic is exactly right to emphasize that this represents both a rejection of consumerism and also a frustrated participation in it at the same time. These are areas that have in many ways been colonized by not so much French industry, but by global industries. These are the areas where people wear Nike shoes, for example, where people download hip-hop songs and videos from throughout the world, places where people are very much intertwined in the global market. Now, it has May 68 also had a relationship to consumer culture, but a very different kind of relationship. During May 68, it was a revolt of people who felt that consumerism was not enough. In the present situation is a revolt of people who feel that they are excluded from consumerism. And what is interesting is that at the same time, these are areas that are in many ways producing some of the most interesting cultural formats in France today. This is it is the banlieue of Paris that are the center of France's hip-hop industry. And this is, France is the second largest producer of hip-hop music and culture in the world today. Much of the most interesting theater comes out of the banlieue and speaks to these kinds of experiences. So there's a sense that, and this is something that has, often been key to the African-American experience, and you now find in France these people are both economically and socially marginal and in many ways culturally central at the same time. And I think the fact that you have they're provoking this kind of crisis in a way that no other group has been able to do in the last 20 years in France really speaks to that, because now they're becoming politically central at the same time. Finally, let me speak briefly to the whole issue of U.S. comparisons. I think one of the points that Loïc made that was really important was the issue of the increasing intolerance of discrimination. There's an article, for example, in today's New York Times that talks about attempts to integrate the French TV industry. And it cites a young woman from Martinique who talks about how when she first tried to get a job in 2000, she was told, well, the French viewing public is not ready for a black TV anchor on the national news. And, you know, had other stories as well to tell. I think what you have is an increasing belief that this is not acceptable on the part of these of the people that are out in the streets. By way of comparison, let me offer this. For example, about 8 or 9 years ago, Newsweek ran a special issue called The State of Black America. It was called The Good News About Black America, with the subtitle, Why Many Blacks Aren't Celebrating. The good news was that illegitimate births were down, unemployment was down, there was a rising black middle class, there was integration into upper echelons of American industry, so on and so forth. So the question was, well, why weren't blacks celebrating? And because the bad news was that progress had been made, but the goal of equality had not been achieved. And in fact, the article made the very trenchant point that if you took the same statistics and made them statistics about white America, America generally will see itself as in a major state of crisis, that this would not be acceptable for the dominant population, but it was seen as progress for a subordinate group. I think you have a similar kind of situation in the French banlieue. People may see them as, in many ways, having progressed, but what these people want is equality with the French because they are French, and they insist on that fact. There is a German sociologist a generation ago who wrote a book about the Social Democratic Party and developed the theme of negative integration. In other words, people are integrated into society in a conflictual manner by the method of trade unions, the Social Democratic Party, socialist parties, or in this case, by taking to the streets. As many French sociologists have pointed out, you have the quote, second generation or even third generation much less willing to accept this kind of behavior because they feel that they are entitled to all the rights of Frenchmen and French women, unlike their parents and grandparents who saw themselves first and foremost as immigrants and therefore grateful to be there. So I think all those questions exist. And I think in looking at the situation now, finally I want to emphasize, as Loïc pointed out, what you're looking at is a kind of endemic ritualized violence. People have pointed out that on every New Year's Eve in France, something like 400 cars go up in flames. Something like 9,000 cars have been burned from the beginning of this year until the outbreak of the riots on October 27th. It reminds me of a situation that used to exist in Detroit called Devil's Night, where every Halloween you would have lots of fires started throughout the city. And nobody called it a riot because it happened every Halloween. But in effect, it was a ritualized kind of, letting off steam, a ritualized kind of expression of anger could not find outlet in any other kind of manner. So I think that's one way of saying that, yes, the story is not over, because I think after the TV cameras go home, you will still have burning cars in the banlieue. And the only difference will be that people will return to the idea that the banlieue is really not a place you have to visit. It is not really a place that counts in French society. But hopefully that will change.
So now we have time for questions, and I will take the microphone so you can ask.
Can you hear me? Yeah. Okay. Well, I wanted to point out also to another kind of incident also which occurred in France, but in the overseas department of Martinique. In 1959, there was a similar riot, as a result of a white gendarme, a French gendarme, riding a motorcycle. There was a death of a Martinican man, and that caused, a riot for, I think, a few days. There were a few deaths and many injured. And scholars have said that, part of the reason why these riots occurred was because Antillians were at the time felt like they didn't have any kind of agency at home. They felt like there was some kind of continuing colonial relations in the Antilles. Since then, they've gained more agency, I think, on a local level, you know, at least politically speaking. And there has been less, there haven't been any kind of rioting. But yet, you have at least 25 to 30% unemployment rate. So my my comment is more so that I believe that these riots or these events are more so related to kind of a process or an environment that make certain people of African descent, of Antillean descent, of Arab descent, feel like they're not at home, although they're, you know, they are at home, you know, that's, so I think part of it, most of it is related to that. And also I have a question, which is related to, in fact, gender, you know. I was wondering, you know, what is the gender dimension of these events? And what does it mean, you know, if are women participating, are women of African descent, Arab descent, are they participating, and what does it mean?
First, I mean, until we have better data, you know, we're all, in a sense, speculating. But the early arrest data suggests that the participants are overwhelmingly men, overwhelmingly young men, mostly ages 13 to 20, and also that they are very mixed. I mean, I think it's not a correct characterization to say they're, you know, mostly men of African descent. So they are really very mixed, like the neighborhoods from which they come. There's only about 5% foreigners in the early count of the RSTs and the announcement after the announcement of Sarkozy that he would expel the foreigners, even if they had legal papers and so on, they would be expelled, which then of course turned out that it's not even possible administratively, you know, and you would violate the European Convention and you have recourses and the, you know, administrative court will not allow it, but it's good announcement to make on TV to say that every foreigner who was caught in a riot will be expelled immediately. But in reality, out of the some 3,000 arrested, only about 5% are foreigners, which is less than the percent, you know, and there's about 7% foreigners in France. So the representation of the foreigners is less among the rioters than it is, largely because this is a homegrown population. And the typical riot in the 1990s, as today, so far as we are able to determine, is really mixed black blanc beurre with, you know, the black kids, Arab, you know, kids of Arab descent and kids of African descent, mixed. And the women, it's interesting, the women are not a participants in the riots, but they're, insofar as we can judge from interviews and from press accounts and from a variety of accounts you can get from friends who go into the neighborhoods and tell you, they are quietly supportive of the events. They're the typical relation. And the typical relation of many of the residents of these areas is exasperation at the youth on the one side and exasperation at the state. So in a sense, it's a double exasperation and a double castigation that they've, you know, they've brought again trouble to the neighborhood. But at the same time, we know why they bring in trouble to the neighborhood, because this is a troubled neighborhood because the state is not doing its job. And so I think you have this you find this ambivalence in the attitude of the women, in particular, who is to support their brothers and cousins and so on, and at the same time realize, you know, that, well, this is not all good news for the neighborhood. And again, it creates this, you know, this sort of, you know, we're on the edge of the knife. You know, are we going to fall to where, you know, in a sense, there's going to be a recurrence of these events before the presidential election sets in, and then therefore forcing the government to actually go more to its left hand and increase social programs, education, housing, and potentially jobs programs? Or is it going to be that, you know, the recurrence of the events is going to be in a configuration such that it allows the state to strengthen its right hand and to send in more police and more courts, you know, and the criminal justice to, in a sense, to where the strategy will be to continue to criminalize the social question, to prevent it from emerging it fully in the political stage. And I think the women from the banlieue who tend to be higher education,
and higher job participation, but also with a very keen sense of their entitlement, you know, particularly to equality and to gender equality, have been, in a sense, you know, the bearers of this ambivalence and the bearers of the very strong demand for the state to deliver their goodies.
Yeah, I read online a comment by a young woman living in the banlieue who was asked this question: what are women doing here? And she said that most women were not involved directly, but she also pointed to the fact that there were some young women, the kind of young women that hung out with guys in gangs and so on and so forth, that did take part, very much like the men they were, the men or boys, however you want to put it, they were hanging out with. And she said, "Ce sont des filles bonhommes, quoi," you know, they girl boys, right? So there is a certain kind of space for that as well. But I think, in general, you do have this sort of division of space. And of course, the question of gender is extremely important for these societies. I mean, there's ways in which, you know, women have different ways of registering their discontent with these societies. But Loïc is also right to emphasize that, you know, in many ways, much like the United States, young women in these areas are much more likely to go on to school, stay in school, go into college, have jobs, not good jobs, but have jobs, than other male counterpoints.
I wanted to add something on religion, because I think it's an important element. I had it in my notes and I skipped it, because that's been one of the dominant tropes, both in France, with, you know, and in a sense the riots are a beautiful Horcrux test of the journalistic and political elite, of their fantasies get projected with this spate of articles about polygamy being one of the roots of the riots. It's because you have these polygamous African families where there's so many wives and so many children, and so these children are running all around. And so they're outside, and so while they're outside, then they riot. You know, sort of a logical, I mean, and then the two other fantasies that have been prevalent is the Islamic fantasy, which in fact is counter to the reality, first of the weak presence of Islam in these neighborhoods. Even when they are North African population, Islam is not much of a presence. I have some statistics here to regale you, for instance, here. Among the children of Algerian and Moroccan parents who live in France today, 60% of the men declare no religion. The native French population, it's only 27% who declare no religion. So the young Algerian men and women, I mean, French people of Algerian descent, are much less likely to declare a religion. They're much less likely to practice a religion. Only 7% of them declare themselves as regularly practicing a religion. That includes all religion. 5% for the men, 6% for the women. Well, that's, you know, the respect for Ramadan and the food taboos associated with Islam, which are much more prevalent, are a way of marking respect for their parents, respect for the tradition from which they come. But they are, generally, they have very little, they are very shallow in terms of religious meaning. They mean more fidelity to the culture and origins of the parents, and they really have not much religious meaning, and certainly no fundamentalist meaning. Religion remains restricted to the private sphere. And more importantly, where there has been a Muslim presence, it has acted as a damper to the violence, because the Muslim groups that are present in some neighborhoods are instillers of discipline and respect for authority, and their role has been to actually go on the, you know, in front of the youth and try to draw them away from their confrontation with the police. So in a sense, if you were in the logic of looking at the role of Islam, you should hail the Islamic, you know, the Islamic presence for having, you know, reduced the virulence of the violence, and you should hail the role of religion as a form of social control. But the fantasy of the civilizational clash of the West versus Islam takes over and leads people to invent, you know, sort of a brewing Islamic presence that would act, you know, as an extra dynamite, when really it's the complete opposite.
It's the fantasy of Al Qaeda and the banlieue.
Yeah, which was there during the first Iraq, the first Gulf War. Mm-hmm. There was the widespread fear, you know, among the political elite. Again, their isolation from the reality of the banlieue. There, you know, I mean, was the root of that. When you have never set foot in these neighborhoods, you can imagine all kinds of things. And when your knowledge from these neighborhoods comes from reading the press, which also doesn't go in these neighborhoods much since the wave of riots of the late 80s and early 90s, because the youth are, in a sense, castigated, are vilified in these press accounts. And so they don't want journalists, and they have a very rough attitude towards the journalists. You know, they, if you come in with a TV camera and so on, you will get beat up and your TV camera broken, because they are tired of this discourse of, you know, the, of demonization. And so the press, therefore, has less knowledge of this milieu today than it did 10 years ago. And the journalist, whose knowledge of the country comes largely from reading the press, in a sense, he's even more removed. Therefore, that creates the conditions under which they can have this sort of wild flights of fancy that are, again, revealing of the degree of isolation and self-enclosure of the political and the media elite as well. You know, and the media, how do they operate when an event like that happens and they don't know, you know, what is really going on? They look at what are the other journalists writing, you know? And so, and as soon as one journalist writes about, well, it's about ethnicity and it's about race and it's about immigration, right? Because that's all that these banlieues are about. And one starts this and everybody else says, oh, you know, keys their report on what the other has said. And so suddenly you have this sort of bandwagon effect where the only interpretation, and they all see, and they all are absolutely convinced that their interpretation is correct because all of their colleagues are giving the same interpretation. Yeah, but that's because the press doesn't go in the banlieue to talk to the people in the banlieue. They read the press and they watch TV. And, you know, and then so it's, so you have a circular reinforcement of this, you know, ethnic reading that then when they go into the banlieue, well, they're not welcome with open arms, and they have difficulty establishing rapport and talking to the youth of the banlieue, you know, and therefore knowing the reality. So this, you know, this ethnic demonization, the centering of, around immigration, creates the condition under which they are less likely to go and more likely to be rejected when they do go, and so their ignorance increases and justifies their continued, you know, interpretation in that fashion.
Okay, I have a question.
Yes. I also wanted to follow up on the topic of the campaign as Muslims not being well integrated and Islamist fundamentalists being responsible for these riots, because you've both talked about this kind of label that came up in the media campaign and how it is addressed by politicians. But in fact, I read an interview with this representative of a neighborhood organization from Saint-Denis, and he was saying that on the other side, and I don't know if that's true, but he was saying that a lot of people who are not Muslims, obviously, but live there, feel also labeled and targeted when this discourse is aiming at them, at that in the banlieues, often it's almost like kind of like a negative sort of collective identity now, and it's perceived like almost like synonymously as excluded working class, or and that it brings this dynamic factor in of not just rejecting, oh, we're not Muslims, it's not a ghost, it's a ghost discourse, but it brings in like some sort of positive identification. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've heard about that or if you want to comment that.
Just a couple comments. I mean, I think it makes sense because, you know, this is why you have this U.S. News and World Report area that says the entire, you know, suburban area of France is just basically Muslim. Or, you know, my wife has done research on, you know, crime and black life in L.A., which points out that whenever a black person is involved in a crime in L.A., no matter where in L.A., it's usually referred to as an incident in South Central L.A. So it could take place in Beverly Hills or, you know, whatever. But because it involves somebody black, it's targeted as in a territorial kind of manner. And I think the same thing is happening in the banlieue in France. I mean, for example, you know, the fact that there's been virtually no reporting on what I think is really true, that there are lots of, quote, regular European descent French people involved in these riots as well, speaks to that, because I think in a lot of ways people feel that it doesn't make any difference. They are all part of this sort of, you know, quote, religiously defined or post-colonial underclass. And the fact that they live in these areas, even though in many cases the majority of these areas are, you know, people of European descent, is not seen as seen as what really counts. And that's, again, what I was trying to get at when I was really emphasizing the idea of the suburbs as sort of outside civilization, you know, as a sort of, you know, sort of noose of poor people that's threatening to strangle the cities. And you know, and when you add the whole issue of Islam into the mix, there again you have Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations in urban space. Let me just make another point, which is that in talking to friends in Paris and other parts of France over the last 2 weeks, I've been struck by the fact that, for example, people that live inside Paris know nothing about what's going on in the banlieue. You know, I mean, they've never been there. They don't have a sense of it. It doesn't affect their daily lives whatsoever. And so the isolation within, you know, these metropolitan areas is really striking.
Let me comment. Let me add something to the representation of the banlieue as this sort of uncivilized wilderness. Because it's really interesting that it's not, you know, which then gets, in a sense, confused and conflated with the question of post-colonial presence and immigration. Because when these banlieues were represented as overwhelming, and were overwhelmingly working class territories, they were also represented as uncivilized.
Absolutely.
You know, and the working class was represented as this internal other. You know, and so, you know, the idea that suddenly all these, you know, this comes from the new kind of population that exists in the banlieue, it's just not true. If you read the accounts of, you know, and also the talk of the ghetto, which the journalists are convinced this is a new phenomenon. You know, there's a book recently published by a French economist called Morin, Le Ghetto Français, that was propped up by Le Monde as this must-read book that tells you the truth about France and this new novel phenomenon, and basically it calls, you know, ghetto an area of poverty. Well, you know, there'd been poverty for, you know, for a long time. We can go back to, you know, the medieval times but what was interesting is that this was supposed to be novel, but you read the accounts of the portrayal of La Courneuve or Bobigny from the 1970s and the 1960s, the same, the wilderness, the ghetto, so the same discourse of, you know, the same othering impulse. And so when people, you know, when there are people of color, it's a little easier because you can sort of, you know, in a sense you can bring in all of the colonial, you know, unconscious. Mm-hmm. But it you know, the othering goes on, and it's just as, in a sense, essentializing when it concerns the working class as when it concerns, you know, ethnically marked population. The other thing I want to remark is the semantic drift that has occurred, even in the terminology used to designate these issues and these realities. It used to be when the first riots from the 80s came out that people talked about banlieue ouvrière, banlieue difficile, and then gradually it became banlieue. Now, banlieue technically means an area ringing around the city. You know? So it could be a very wealthy area, and it used to be, people used the term banlieue to say, when you said banlieue 15 years ago, you didn't know if you meant you know, the rich suburb of Neuilly, where Sarkozy is mayor, or the poor suburbs of Évry and, you know, Bobigny and so on. But now there's been a complete drift where banlieue means only the lower class, declining, and in the collective imagination, immigrant, Islamic. You know. Worse than that, the term quartier, which means neighborhood. You know, it used to be, you talked about quartier ouvrier, quartier en déclin, quartier des banlieues, the neighborhood of the banlieue. Then there was a drift to quartier sensible, sensitive neighborhood, which was the official state designation to name the territories that would be the object of special urban renewal programs and so on and so forth, basically trying to give an urban solution to a social question, which of course it didn't work. So when it didn't work, you know, you rename them, you know, and every 5 years there's a new program. I mean, the cacophony that is urban policy in France is absolutely astounding. Every 3 to 5 years, all the names change, all the neighborhoods get renamed, all the programs are uprooted, get started from scratch, you know, and you add more layers, it's like a millefeuille. You know, you have more layers and layers and layers, and then, you know, people in the neighborhood don't understand what's going on, the local authorities don't understand, and the politicians don't understand, but they've put another millefeuille, another layer to protect themselves from facing the reality. That's really basically the function of the urban policy. But then there was a drift to quartier sensible, to simply quartier. Well, now when you say quartier and you listen to the French news or read in the newspaper, when people say quartier, neighborhood, they mean only declining lower class neighborhood that is a problem territory holding a problem population. You can't say, if you say, I live in a quartier, I live in a neighborhood. Where doesn't everybody live in a neighborhood? No, that means I live in a bad neighborhood. So I mean, it's really remarkable how the whole urban language has been recoded to refer strictly solely to these particular territories and population. And in the reporting, there's been also a remarkable speed. Now, you know, this is an impression from watching the news, which you can watch on the web. You can watch both Antenne 2 and TF1, so you can watch the news every night. It's been very time-consuming the last 3 weeks, because I don't have the time to watch all the news. But a preliminary analysis, you know, again, this is not, I haven't done the hard data and so on. And, you know, again, all of this is provisional, because nobody has the hard data to really, you know, sort of fully prove a point.
except that I think we have a job to do to prevent the existing pre-coded interpretation to taking such a hold that you can't even analyze the problem afterwards. But my sense from watching the news is that whenever there have been pictures of the rioters, they have entailed, you know, a fair amount of colored faces. And whenever there have been people in the neighborhoods that have been the victim of the violence, and people who are protesting, very strangely, they have been overwhelmingly white, you know, which suggests, well, there is a strong white presence in the neighborhood. Now, you know, again, the split, it would be interesting to see if the splits come from the journalists, in a sense, that's the framework within which they enter the neighborhood, or that's how they're able to recruit people, or that those are the people who will let themselves be interviewed, and so on and so forth. But it's very striking that at minimum, there's a very strong white presence in those neighborhoods, since every time there's somebody to protest the riots inside the neighborhood, it's not overwhelmingly the white presence. So clearly the neighborhoods are a little more mixed than the other side of the coverage gives us the impression of.
Okay, I have three questions, and I suggest, because of the time constraint, that they just...
Together,
okay?
I'll try to say this quickly. I think the most disturbing thing that you've both developed is the complete Americanization of the entire French policy construction and political construction in response. And I think it's important to say Americanization, not just neoliberal, because of the specific lack of any intermediate representation, organized representation from within France, and this presidentialization effect that I really appreciate you brought out as being what has dominated political definition in this country increasingly for decades. So someone who works on American policies myself is very disheartened to hear that I would have expected French politics to have a little more capacity, even despite the neoliberal... So to me, the missing part of both of this conversation is why there was no counterforce to this kind of globalization and no ability to articulate the real communities and the real points. Yeah. And my final point, I think I so appreciate you bringing up the change in the instruments of incorporation. Instead of integration or not, finally, you've raised different sectors of incorporation, which I think is always missing from this discussion.
Thank you very much for your persuasive analysis. I think the focus on social issues is very much welcome. And in this respect, I wanted to ask you a question, and that's regarding the labor market. And neoliberal economists often refer to a sort of a dual labor market. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, those who are inside and who are well protected, particularly in France, under labor protection, and that they can't be fired so easily as they can, for example, in the US, and so on. And neoliberal economists then often argue that this actually makes jobs that are sort of the interim jobs more precarious and so on. And they therefore argue that labor protection should be reduced and so on in order to have more growth and therefore employment. And I mean, this strikes me as a very much an ideological discourse, but at the same time, I would like to know how you would respond to this kind of argument, because at the root analysis of the of the cause of the riots would be congruent with yours, I suppose.
Before I give you the diagram, I just would like to point out that you came up with a very good point, and I think it should be the discussion of a second panel, is why don't you have more riots in the U.S.?
My question is a two-point question. Basically, first of all, Khan, you underscore the question of the autonomization of the political system. And the point itself of the political system in France since essentially the Second World War has been automizing the elite from the people. And you could say that the way that the French economy and the French political economy was developed and the way it was essentially isolating the anarchy from essentially the peasants and then from mass society in general. And what you could be in the same time, you're saying that you're seeing as a basic dysfunction in the way the economy as a whole works, from which this specific people are being excluded especially. And what many commentators are saying about the French political economy in general, it is that essentially what you're saying, that the French model in itself and the French state model in itself has come to a point in which, specifically for the optimization of the state, for the optimization of the elite, has very few possibilities of change and very few places to go. So where, if anywhere, could the reform of the, in the end, in your terms, the French political economy could go to solve, in the end, a problem which is, in this case, just a symptom of a greater malaise? And the second question, something we've been seeing in Europe in quite a bit is this, the people in general from the anatomized state, and which are themselves disorganized or individualized in a very strong sense, in the front of an effacement, essentially in a very rapid way going against the center. And this has happened in Spain, it happens all the time in France, either in this way or by other forms of organization. And my question would be, again, what type of social response, which is in the end different than this, could arise from this general dynamic?
I'll try to answer the three questions as a package, because I think they are linked. First, I think the institutional changes introduced by the recent constitutional reform that went from a presidency of 7 years that has its own temporality to a presidency of 5 years that has the same temporality of the congressional election has really changed. Has accelerated the incipient presidentialization of the French political system, which was already pushed by the forces of marketing, political marketing, of the role of the media, and so on. I think it's been very key. It's been very key because the fact that this is Act One of the presidential campaign of 2007, in a sense, pretty much very much limits the kind of policy response that is possible. The fact that the Socialist Party is paralyzed right now with its own internal fights and I think there's an enormous responsibility in all of this. This goes back to your question. So I think that looking at the structure of the political system and its working is one element. Looking at the way this has also facilitated the importation of American-style solutions to the management of social problems, in particular, in a sense, the penalization of poverty as a strategy for managing the poor. That's the topic of my book, Punishing the Poor, coming out next year in English with Duke University Press, in which I invite the Europeans to return and to look at the invention of this policy in the U.S., because this is the policy that is coming, at a neighborhood, at a lower class neighborhood near you. And so if you want to know, what its roots are and what its dilemmas and what its implications are, in a sense, study them where they've been invented. The change in the instruments of incorporation, I think it is important, in a sense, to call the misinterpretation of the sort of the rosy mythology of republican integration, which there's in particular a book that's available in English that I strongly recommend is Gérard Noiriel, The French Melting Pot, that analyzes the process whereby waves, France for a long time, until very recently, thought of itself as not a country of immigration, as a very old nation formed in the 12th century. But in reality, it is a country of immigration. In fact, it's been more of a country of immigration than the U.S. If you look at the percentage of immigrants relative to the native population between 1880 and 1910, which is the peak of U.S. immigration during the era of industrial urbanization, France received more immigrants per capita than the U.S. did. But France construed itself as this homogeneous population that didn't have ethnic differences. In fact, there have always been strong ethnic differences, in particular regional differences. But these were, in a sense, these were overwhelmed by the late and powerful forms of, in particular, forms of class formation. And it's, in a sense, the unmaking of the traditional French working class and the new modalities of emerging of a new urban proletariat that now, you know, creates a situation where the traditional mode of incorporation is no longer there, and suddenly France finds that it has to live up to its so-called integration model. Then the second mistake is that then people typically interpret that incorporation of immigrants is not working. And I think all indicators show that, in fact, it is working, and that's why there is the conflict. And that's why Le Pen has a market. Otherwise, how would he have said something? If the immigrants continue to be marginalized and excluded, then why would anybody worry about them? And what would Le Pen be selling? And what would Sarkozy be selling? Because Sarkozy, you know, is trying to get the Le Pen voters and to basically attach them to his coattails now, so that later in the campaign he can then try to, you know, get the center-right voters. Of course, the dilemma is how many of the center-right voters is he going to get after the position that he's taken? So, you know, this is yet to be seen. Last, I would make a distinction between the state and the political field. You know, I'm using Bourdieu's concept of the bureaucratic field on the one side as the set of public institutions that manage, you know, that claim monopoly over the manipulation of the distribution of public goods, public bureaucracies, if you wish, the state, independent of the political personnel and the time and days and parties and so on, and then the political field, as in particular, you know, parliament, organizations, and the political system with the parties. And I think that the political field, in Bourdieu's sense of the term, is a space of contention and representation that is structurally heteronomous. It has to be rooted, it has to be grounded in social space. And the political actors have to be tied, have an organic relationship to the collectives which they both fabricate and represent. What has happened in the recent period, in my view, is that the political, but it has to have enough autonomy for political work to be effective. What has happened, in my view, lastly, it has to do with both the bureaucratic field that has been recomposed, and in particular, where the left hand of the state, the hand of the social worker, and so on, has been weakened relative to the right hand, particularly the hand of the police, criminal justice apparatus, as a means of controlling these populations. And secondly, there's been a change in the political field itself with a pathological degree of autonomy. In a sense, you know, you could say, as I said, you know, earlier, the critique of the U.S. political system is that it's not autonomous enough. It's the basically, you know, sadly, it's become the caricatural, you know, executive committee of the ruling class. But in France, it's not the executive committee of the ruling class, but it's become too much of a game, you know, where the politicians are only oriented towards themselves, as opposed to being oriented towards their constituents. And so I think it is this pathological, excessive autonomization of the political field, closing onto itself and latching onto the media field. I mean, then, you know, one would need to do a broader analysis of the transformation of the field of journalism, particularly under this, you know, the privatization of televisions and, you know, the growing pressure towards, you know, marketing-oriented reporting and so on and so forth. And it's basically latched. The politicians are oriented to the media, and the media are oriented to the politicians, and they speak only to each other. And who's forgotten? The rest of the country. You know, and I think the excessive marketization, the excessive de-autonomization of the media field, and the excessive autonomization of the political field creates a situation where it's very hard for the political elites to come up to even think of a viable solution because they don't even have the right diagnosis. And here I'll close with that. The ultimate responsibility is actors that are not crucially involved in the current debate, who should be, is the Socialist Party. The Socialist Party bears an overwhelming responsibility in first having reformed, having gone along with the reform of the Constitution, creating the five-year presidency, having inverted the calendar of congressional and presidential election, making the presidential election the pivotal political moment in all of French political life, and being so concerned with their own, you know, internal jockeying that they've lost all connection to the working classes which they are supposed to represent, you know, and their strategy of orienting themselves only to the cultural bourgeoisie is turning out to be, you know, their death knell.
Let me just make one very quick point about this. As bad as the situation that Lucas has described is, at least you do have some sort of relationship between these events and the political system in France. By way of comparison, the 1992 Rodney King riots took place in the middle of a presidential election campaign. And they, you know, somebody at one, I think there was a debate between the Democratic primary candidates, and some reporter, only one, brought up this issue, and there was like dead silence. There was no addressing of this issue, the largest riots in American history, none at all, from the political system. So that may be a hopeful note.
Yeah. Okay. I would like to thank you, and we have already a topic for a second panel. Thank you, Van.
Yes. That would not be hard.